Morning, Your Honor. Jennifer Swigert again, this time on behalf of the appellant, Melanie Terry. And I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal again. It's undisputed that prosecutors are officers of the court who share in the responsibility to ensure that accused persons receive a fair trial. That's why it's considered distinctly improper to rely on appeals to the passion, prejudice, or emotions of the jury, as well as to rely on facts that are outside the evidence that's presented to the jury. In this case, the opening thrust of the prosecutor's argument was not about proving the elements of second-degree burglary. It was about arousing the jury's fears and speculations about what might have happened under different circumstances.
Curable by an instruction?
No, Your Honor, because this is the type of, essentially it was an appeal to the jury's fear. I would distinguish it from State v. Emery, where the misstatements of the law were at issue that were pertaining to things like the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Those are the types of things that jurors know that they need to rely on the instructions for. These are things that jurors, unless they're lawyers, don't really have an experience of. They know that they need to refer to instructions about them. Factual questions are the same thing. The jury knows the only knowledge they have about this series of events is what occurred, is the testimony that they've heard from people in the trial and the evidence. They know that they have to look to the instructions for the law. They know that they have to look to the testimony and the exhibits for the evidence. But in this case, we have essentially an emotional appeal. That's the type of thing that's likely to get under the juror's skin and taint their assessment of everything, even if they're instructed to disregard what was going on. Essentially, the prosecutor asked the jury to speculate that Ms. Terry was a violent person who was likely to have done physical harm to these people, and there simply was no evidence to support that.
So she did have a knife in her back pocket as she walked back to the station wagon.
And there was also evidence of exactly how those knives were used. There were pry marks found at the window. One of the officers testified that it looked like they'd been trying to pry the window open. These knives were things that were clearly being used as burglary tools. On the facts of the case, when they were confronted by the homeowners, both of the people apparently involved fled. They didn't try to do any sort of fighting or confronting. So there's simply no evidence to support any sort of an argument that this was a violent crime, that Ms. Terry was a violent person ready to do harm to anyone. This was a nonviolent offense. And so by this argument, frequently and repeatedly referring to what might have happened and, oh, these poor, naive homeowners and what would have happened had they, you know, turned the wrong corner, opened the wrong door at the wrong moment, it basically just aroused the jury's fear of violence when that was not really even an issue in this case at all.
Well, hadn't the victims actually testified to that, that when they noticed that she had the knife in the pocket, they backed off, they were fearful?
Yes, yes, Your Honor, but that's not one of the elements that was required to be proved in this case. It was utterly irrelevant to any of the elements that the prosecution was trying to prove. So the only possible purpose in closing argument would be to arouse the fear and the emotions of the jury so that those could taint their perception of what happened in this case. We're supposed to be, as a justice system, if we condemn someone, we do that because they are responsible for what happened, not because of the jury's fear of what might have happened, because the prosecutor's remarks here were utterly irrelevant to any element of the charge. And
in Russell, the court dealt with a closing argument that talked about, you know, if you turn this guy loose, he could be out in the community killing other people, and appealed to fears, and the court there concluded, well, that was curable by instruction. Why wouldn't that work? We've talked about that, but why isn't this closer to Russell than some other cases?
It's not like Russell because certainly the remarks. The short answer to that question is that Russell is a multiple murder case. The defendant in Russell was proved to have murdered several people. So the question of the court was looking at, is this really inflammatory, based on the fact that the facts of the case themselves are already so gruesome and so essentially inflammatory and are likely to provoke an emotional response just without any embellishment whatsoever. And so under those circumstances, the prosecutor's remarks were not likely to really arouse any more revulsion, with the court word the court used, than the facts of the case already did. That's very different from this case, where we have second-degree burglary categorized as a nonviolent offense. And so we don't have, you know, extremely graphic, extremely violent facts that are inherent in the offense itself. Instead, we have the prosecutor's remarks essentially elevating this crime from one that's a nonviolent property offense to something that arouses the jury's fears for their own personal safety. So that's how I believe this case is significantly different from Russell on that basis.
Are you going to address the sufficiency of the evidence argument?
Yes, briefly, Your Honor. The crux of that argument is that the legislature is presumed, when they use different language, to have a different meaning behind that different language. And so we have several different definitions of possessing stolen property: possessing, retaining, concealing, disposing of. Under the prosecutor's proposed definitions for dispose of, that it simply means to put something somewhere, we're left with, how is that really any different from what the legislature has already listed as prohibited activities? Possessing, retaining, concealing, it's essentially superfluous, and statutes are presumed to not include superfluous language. So our argument is that disposing of has to mean something different from just possessing it and then setting it down. That's not good enough to prove disposing of. There simply is no evidence that she intended to throw it away or to transfer it to another person.
Is that how you define it, throw it away or transfer?
Those are the remaining definitions that aren't sort of already covered by the listed definitions in the statute. So that's the meaning that under the canon of statutory interpretation, that words are presumed to have a different meaning when they use a different word. Those are the remaining meanings. And I would also point out simply that the Modern Sewer Corporation case that the state relies on is not particularly helpful. It's an entirely different context, Model Toxics Act, I believe, and there's not a similar, that statute doesn't include a similar listing of these many different, it doesn't have to be different from possession, from retention, from concealing, as it does in this case. And so we would ask that the court reverse Ms. Terry's convictions because the prosecutor committed misconduct that was likely to affect the verdict, and hold that the possession of stolen property conviction must be dismissed for insufficient evidence. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Jeremy Morris, deputy prosecutor from Kitsap County, appearing today as a special deputy prosecutor here for San Juan County and asking this court to affirm the judgment and sentence below. I think on the prosecutorial misconduct claim, I outlined in my brief how I think the prosecutor's statements are far different than what we've heard about in some of the other cases in Russell, for instance. Here, we're talking about a factual scenario that the jury heard, where this retired couple goes into their home and this dangerous situation ensues.
What's certainly the point of bringing that topic up, though? We're sure lucky they didn't go up that ladder. Who knows what would have happened if they'd gone out that window? We're just all lucky we don't have a more serious crime.
Well, I think the facts of this case presented that scenario. I mean, Mr. Rankin himself talked about how he felt silly.
We're sure lucky they didn't have a gun. We're sure lucky they weren't out there to kill somebody.
Well, but that's not what the prosecutor here said.
Just going down the same road.
Well, he said, what would have happened? And I think that's exactly what Mr. Rankin said. Gosh, I felt foolish for thinking there were raccoons causing these noises in the house and going in with the vacuum cleaner hose. I think everybody on the jury said, yeah, that was foolish. In that situation, that was silly because an unnecessary confrontation could have ensued. The prosecutor here didn't say Miss Terry would have bloodily, you know, murdered these people. He just said what would have happened, and it was a foolish thing. It was a naive thing for the Rankins to do, which is clearly supported by the evidence. But even if we say, fine, that's improper argument, this is the road that the prosecutor shouldn't have went down, I think this is clearly a situation that could have been cured by an instruction here. There's no objection below, and I think for good reason, that it simply wasn't that inflammatory of a comment, given the evidence that the jury heard.
You're taking the position it was not flagrant or ill-intentioned because of the evidence.
That's correct. That's the first argument. I think, you know, when I think about this test for prosecutorial misconduct, I think if you can see several different scenarios. I think when we're dealing with crimes, whether or not they're classified for sentencing purposes as a violent crime or not, this court has recognized, and I think everyone understands, that the crime of burglary creates a dangerous situation because you have an invasion of a home by strangers. When we're dealing with crimes, there's always some element of danger, of emotion, I mean, because we're dealing with crimes. I don't think it's improper at all for a prosecutor to comment on the facts of the case and the situation that was presented to the jury. Here, the only arguable problem is the prosecutor said, what could have happened? I think that's a far cry from a situation where in Russell, where we're saying, well, if you let this guy out, he's going to go kill another person. That's not nearly the situation we have here. We have this, really what the prosecutor is saying is we have a burglary. That creates an inherently confrontational, a potential for a confrontation in a home, which is a problem, and that's why the crime is outlawed. One of the reasons that it's treated with the seriousness that it is as a felony and not a shoplifting or a theft. So I think there's a distinction between saying a purely emotional impact versus commenting really on what the evidence was presented to the jury. In the Pierce case, for instance, the counsel cited in her brief where the prosecutor is giving this fictionalized narrative of what the victim saw as they were lying there wounded, I think is you know a far cry from what we have here, which is coming on, which is based in the evidence that the jury actually heard. So that's the first argument. Second is I think this is exactly the type of case that could have been cured by an instruction if one had been requested. And third, that...
What case are you relying on that it could have been cured? Are you relying on Russell?
Russell's an example. I mean, the test itself is laid out in numerous places, Emory and Thornton's.
Well, is there some case that you think is analogous or that we should look at that is like this?
Well, I suppose Russell is the strongest point. I mean, there's a much more egregious comment that the court said was not the type that couldn't have been cured and was likely to have had a substantial likelihood of affecting the verdict. And I think that's really the third prong here. Is this comment, what could have happened, likely to have affected the verdict here? And I think any fair reading of the evidence is that that's absolutely not the type of comment that would have affected the verdict here. We had a very clear and strong case where their burglary had occurred. There was no dispute about that. The items are found in the defendant's car. Her defense is that these are her coats, which was clearly rebutted by the photographs of this retired couple wearing each of the items years earlier. So it was an extremely weak defense, an extremely strong prosecution case. And to say that the prosecutor's statement, what could have happened, what might have happened if Mr. Rankin hadn't been so naive, it simply could not have had does not have a substantial likelihood of affecting the verdict here. I don't really have anything else to add on that prong, unless you have a question.
No, just are you going to address the
sure, I think to dispose of the evidence? I mean, I think what counsel's argument at the end was that we have to, there's a list of words in the statute, and we have to take the dictionary definition that's the most antagonistic or the furthest from the other things in the list. It's just absolutely inconsistent with how this court has dealt with possession in the past. The Washington courts have already said that there's a redundancy in that list. I mean, we have possession, receive, and retain, and those are all types of things that overlap. There is redundancy there. And the courts have acknowledged that. I mean, if you receive and retain something, that implies you possess it. You can't really receive it without possessing it. You can't retain it without possessing it. There's overlap there. We don't look for mutually exclusive definitions, and there's simply no authority to say that when you go to the dictionary, if there's one that's a definition that's close, we exclude that. We pick the one that's furthest. I mean, that's just not how statutory construction's ever worked in my experience. And I think it does have a different nuance, the dictionary definitions, the first ones, to put away, to place, to arrange. Those are slightly different than to just possess or receive or retain. I mean, they're talking about actions with the particular item. And that's exactly what we have here, that she took these items, the three coats and blanket, I believe, that were in her car, went to her mother's house, and they were found in a box by the front door. I think that's the dictionary definition of dispose of. They were placed, put away, arranged, deposited, which are all slightly different than possess, receive, or retain, but are all dictionary definitions of dispose of. So I think the evidence was clearly sufficient here. And the only way you get to it not being sufficient is the two arguments that the counsel raised in brief, one, that dispose of requires a transfer to another person, which we know can't be the case. That would be trafficking in stolen property, and it would render it, the statute, pointless and redundant. So then it's to throw away. But again, I mean, there's simply no support that that's the only definition of dispose and that that's what the legislator intended here, and that's the only way council can prevail on that claim. So I would ask this court to affirm, unless you have other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a couple of brief points in rebuttal, Your Honor. In my personal restraint of Glassman, also considered prosecutorial misconduct, and described the issue as whether the comments deliberately appealed to the jury's passion and prejudice and encouraged the jury to base the verdict on improper argument rather than on the properly admitted evidence. And I believe that describes what the prosecutor did in these two opening paragraphs. This wasn't just a passing comment. This was the first two opening paragraphs of the closing argument, focusing the jury's attention on considerations that were entirely improper and entirely irrelevant to the elements of the offense. This was essentially the prosecutor placing a thumb on the scale, that thumb being the jury's fear that something like this could happen to them, that there might have been some violence, that someone might have been hurt, none of which is based on the facts of this case. If a person's going to be condemned, they should be condemned on the facts relevant to the elements of the offense, not because the prosecutor encourages the jury to engage in fear-based speculation about unnamed dangers. And so we would ask this court to reverse Ms. Terry's convictions.
Thank you both.
Thank you
very much. Next up is Young versus